The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm excited for this one. The first, and I think maybe still the only Master Somm in New Zealand, but it is Cameron Douglas. And for more information, go to camdouglas.com. The website's probably not relevant for anyone in Canada right now, but hopefully somewhere down the road it will be. But people listen to this podcast all over the world. Just one of the smartest guys when it comes to wine, not just New Zealand, but globally. And again, the man is a Master Somm. It is pretty damn impressive. There it is, Cam Douglas, MS.com. Cam, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah, and by the way, it's only an audio podcast. What you don't see is Cam put his card up, because I just camdouglas.com. It's Cam Douglas MS. And why do we start there? Before we get into all things New Zealand wine, which if anyone listens to this podcast knows how obsessed I am about the wines from your nation. I'd love to go back and first, actually, before we get into the into you studying and everything to become a Master Somm, did I read it right? Not only were you the first and only one in New Zealand, were you the first individual in the Southern Hemisphere to get the Master Somm designation?
As far as I'm aware, I am. There are two gentlemen that were expat Australian that passed their Master Sommelier exam after they had emigrated to the US and the UK. So notwithstanding those two, I'm pretty sure I was the first, yeah.
Did you ever use that in a bar, restaurant, at a party where like, yeah, it's like, I'm not just only New Zealand, in the Southern Hemisphere. That's not a bad line to throw around. That's a pretty good humble brag.
Yeah, my ego doesn't extend that far. I don't like leveraging too much. I'd rather people take me on face value first. And if they're interested in the Master Sommelier journey or something like that, I might include it in the conversation occasionally, but I pitch it every now and again.
Considering the hours it takes, the days, the months, the years, I would find ways of jamming it in every conversation, from dinner parties to filling up my car with gas. But you mentioned the word journey. I'd love for you to tell the listeners a little bit more about your journey. First, what was it that originally got you into going down this path of wine?
Well, it's not an unfamiliar story, but it's one that is unique to me, simply because of the setting and the location where I'm at. And to cram a long story short in just a few sentences, I began my hospitality career in a hotel, working in a banquet department, and realized that there was a lot more money to be made working in restaurants rather than in hotels. And pretty soon after starting my foray into hospitality and in restaurants, I discovered a passion for food and decided that I wanted to become a chef. And I think that part of the journey of any sommelier is food just comes in there somewhere along the line, either in your own kitchen or working in a kitchen for a restaurant or otherwise. And I think that that set me up very, very nicely for understanding aromas and flavors in food, and textures in food and aromas and flavors in food and wine draw lots and lots of parallels. But a couple of years into cooking and a few redundancies along the way, I decided that I might be better off working in the front of house of operations, and started work in a restaurant and then restaurants as the front of house. There was one particular restaurant that I worked at called Papillon. And it was set up by a gentleman who curated the wine list himself. He owned the restaurant and he worked the floor in the restaurant as much as he possibly could, as well as managing the restaurant. And he would spend a lot of his spare time traveling around New Zealand, driving mostly, tasting and collecting wine. And when he brought that back to the restaurant, I would shadow him and listen to him with the customers, telling them stories about how he discovered the wine, what the wine was like, where he got it from, and why they should be buying that wine. And it was fascinating and interesting because it was much as much about the conversation with customers as it was making those recommendations. So it led me and encouraged me to head down that path myself, because one thing is very obvious in hospitality operations anywhere in the world is that there are few positions in senior management anywhere. The glass ceiling is very low in restaurants, I believe, or in my experience, it is anyway. So, you know, a shift manager is one thing, a manager is another. And then where do you go from there? So it's quite easy to burn out if you're not careful in restaurants and hotels for that matter. So what do? You specialize, you go back to the kitchen, you specialize front of house, or you burn out and do something different. And I chose to try and specialize in the sector of wine mainly and became a sommelier. There were, you know, a few jobs in between in terms of hotels and in restaurants, but the focus was always wine and selling wine, collecting and learning and tasting wine. Eventually, and we're talking, 8 or 9 years later, maybe even more, I worked as a full-time sommelier in a restaurant next door to Papillon, funnily enough, called Vinny's Restaurant. And there I became the sommelier and worked there for a full decade as the somm. And whilst I was there, I became party to a conversation with my wife and one of the regular guests who happened to be a magazine editor and said, what am I going to do? You know, you're clearly very good at what you're doing, but where are you going to take this from here? And this magazine editor, her name was Lorraine, she put me in touch with a gentleman called Evan Goldstein, who was a master sommelier in the USA and was heavily involved in the Court of Master Sommeliers at that time. And we got to talking, and that led me to a trip to Las Vegas about 8 or 9 months later to participate in the introductory level program for the Quartermaster Sommeliers Americas, sitting in one of their great ballrooms with 149 other candidates. And it was a very eye-opening, challenging few days because it makes you realize how much you don't know when you engage in programs like this. You might love wine and you might love people and connecting people in wine, but the rigors attached to learning, educating yourself, learning how to taste wine and identify wines blind, polishing your service skills, and then realizing that the world of theory of beverages, let alone wine, is very wide and very deep. But I started. That's where it all began.
And it's an incredible journey. All right, let's go with this then. I have about 100 more questions. We'll get to a few of them during this podcast.
Okay.
What were the 6 months like leading up to you taking the Master Sommelier, the highest level? Not introductory, not intermediate, not advanced, but the 6 months before the final level, the MS level, what was your days and nights like?
Well, in addition to working full time,
yep,
I had to find out what should I be reading, what should I be tasting, how do I access these wines, how do I access these books? So I needed to seek a lot of advice. I got some of that advice from Evan himself, but I also got advice from other people that I was immediately connected to globally by engaging in this program. So there are many, many books that you can purchase and start reading. And one of the hardest books to attain at that time was The Sales and Service for the Wine Professional by Brian Julian. It simply wasn't available in New Zealand, and I wasn't able to even access that book until after I took that first program. So I knew that I could get the Jancis Robinson Encyclopedia of Wine, or the Oxford. I got that. There was a Hugh Johnsis Jancis Robinson book that I was able to access. And then there was the Sotheby's Encyclopedia of Wine. And I think of all of those three, the Sotheby's one was the one that I knew that I could read. It had maps, it had summaries, it had varieties, it had tasting ideas in amongst all of those pages. But I think the hardest thing really was learning how to learn, if that makes sense.
Because, of course.
you know, reading a novel is one thing. Reading a recipe book is something different, but actually reading to learn and invade your brain with information that you think is worth remembering is really tough. And it wasn't until post the first level that I really discovered how I learned best, and that was to rewrite the material that I was reading, if that makes sense. So I would take a whole chapter of a textbook and I would rewrite it in my words, and then I would read it out loud to myself.
Cameron,
was big.
I can interrupt for a half second, sorry. And only because when my highest level, way lower than yours, diploma for WSET, I used to do the same thing. I would write it on giant Bristol board, and then I would go to the roof of my condo and I would walk back and forth holding it, reading things out loud, going over every growth and every major region in Italy and every wind and mountain. So yes, that what you're saying makes total sense.
And that's part of the journey, I have to say, as well, is if you're going to become a sommelier, whether or not it's with credentials, whether or not you want to reach that highest peak, part of the future at whatever level you're at is paying it forward. It's being able to be available to people who want to engage in that journey and showing them the pathway. They just have to walk through the door. I've had telephone conversations with people around the world, emails with people around the world, simply wanting to know how to begin, right? And that's something I very much enjoy, telling them what to read or advising them on what to read, and people who are stuck on blind tasting and how they could develop their technique better. That's part of the pleasure of being a master.
Oh, of course. As you mentioned, once you get into it, the first thing you realize is, oh, God, I have so much I don't know. And I think wine is, it is all humbling, because no matter what, there's always some Italian varietal you've never tried before. There's always stuff to learn. I'm curious for you, for all the service, the theory and the tasting to get the master. Is there anything that you remember from those days that stick out? A tough moment, it was someone trying to trip you up in service, a crazy hard question in theory, or a blind wine taste where you're like, oh, I nailed it. I absolutely nailed it. Or on the other end, I have no bleeping idea what I'm trying.
There's one thing that will never change, and that is a degree of nervousness when you enter an exam room for any test, any assessment whatsoever. I remember knowing that I was sweating so much under my jacket and under my shirt that I'm sure that I forgot to say things in a blind tasting exam. I remember the day that I passed my master's tasting exam in London, that the suit I was wearing was so fitting that I sat down and it tore open down the leg when I sat down. So I sat my entire exam with half my leg exposed, but they couldn't see it anyway. That was really kind of fun. One of the exams I entered into, in fact, it was the first time I took the advanced service exam, I had pockets full of equipment. Absolutely, I could jam pocket, you know, if a cork fell into the bottle, I had a piece of equipment jammed into my pocket that could remove that. Not that I've ever practiced it, but I knew I had that tool just in case. And, you know, an extra wine key and two cigarette lighters to, you know, at that time you would have to prepare a cigar for service. It's no longer required. But in fact, I did that in one of my exams. And they said, we want to see all your equipment before you walk into this room. And of course, we're unloading things like, you know, weapons and knives and movies and things like that. But it's all wine keys and cork pulling equipment and things like that. And they said, you don't need any of this. You just need a ballpoint pen, a piece of paper, and a corkscrew. And that's all we were allowed into the room. And I, what would I do if this situation arrived? But none of it happened. They walk you through what you're supposed to do. They tell you what you're going to do, and then they throw a few curveballs in there. But it's not an exam to make you fail. It's an exam to test that you've reached a level.
Do you remember any of the questions you got asked at the master level or beyond ripping of pants? And I bring this up because people are always curious about what the wines you have to try. And it's, you know, it's three different Albarinos just to screw you over. I mean, people, I'm always curious about any of those moments.
It's quite a long time ago now. It was 2007 when I set those final exams. I think when it comes to, say, service at master's level, the key is the theory, because you're already polished at a service, and it, the key is not to rush things as well. Everything is timed, but if you if you speed things up too much, you're going to miss points that are available to you. Listening to questions that are being asked of you whilst you're pulling the cork of a vintage Bordeaux and decanting it very slowly for two masters is the key. And they're throwing questions at you about the wine you're opening, who the winemaker is, was it a good vintage that you're suddenly now opening, and what would happen if that you were dealing with a corked wine or a faulty wine of some kind. And then it's about the execution of answering questions while you're executing the service of pouring that wine from a decanter and so on. But I remember distinctly during one of the service exams, in fact, Evan was one of the masters at my table, and they started an argument with me about the pricing of a wine.
Really?
And yeah. And it was to test my ability not to argue back, but to explain in a rational, calm way why a wine is priced the way it is. And ultimately, the customer gets to choose whether they select and pay for that wine or not. And it's one of the few industries where you pay for something after you've consumed it, right?
Yep.
Food and beverage alike. So it's your salesmanship and your ability to stay calm and read the psychology at the table at the same time.
Before we move on, one last question of this theme, but not necessarily about the Master Somm and all of that, but just in general, over the years, I'm sure you've been involved with blind tastings, either at fun parties or for events and contests. Do you have any favorite moments and most embarrassing moments where you were completely off on a wine, or one where you were really proud, you nailed it, the producer, the vintage, everything in between? I always like to hear the story. I always like to hear the stories of glory and the bad defeats, if you have either that you remember.
Well, I remember distinctly when I can't remember his first name, but Mr. Gilbert, we'll call him, who was the US ambassador to New Zealand. And this is in a time when Barack Obama was president of the United States. And I was invited to the home where they were staying in Wellington, and was invited to a dinner party there. And without knowing it, they'd set me up with a blind tasting at the table. And there were a few dignitaries at the table. And Mr. Gilbert said, "Cameron, we'd love you to tell us about this wine and taste it and tell us what you think it might be."
Oh, they snuck it up on you. They snuck it up on you.
Me, all right? And to be honest, I don't remember what the brand is, but I nailed the wine, right? It was fresh enough in my mind. The process was fresh enough. And I actually just simply walked them through the process by looking at the color of the wine. It was a red wine. It ended up being a Pinot Noir from Central Otago, somewhere like that. And I looked at the color, the translucency, the lack of color staining in the tears. I took in those aromas that were more of those light red fruit groups rather than dark red fruit groups. There was, you know, a reasonable amount of oak, but it wasn't overt, and it certainly wasn't American oak. And I walked through the process in about 5 minutes, and I said, "I think this is this particular variety from this place." And they said, "Yep, that's right, 100% correct."
Ah, nice. Congrats.
Yeah. I've been to tastings, group blind tastings at events, and failed miserably. Absolutely failed miserably. So it's, you know, there's no guarantees.
No, I've seen the smartest people call a Sangiovese a Bordeaux. I mean, this sort of thing happens. So yeah. let's
go over. Part of the challenge, is not compartmentalizing a wine too soon. it's got the smell, therefore it must be that. You actually have to figure out the structure first, and does it match? What varieties or styles does the structure of wine match first? And then layer in the flavor after that and see where that might take you.
It's so true, but it's something a lot of us are guilty of, is we will rush ahead. We see the color, we give a smell, and we're like, oh, I've nailed it. And then, you know, your brain just goes, okay, no. I know my tongue is saying medium plus acid. Ah, this is more medium because I've already decided what the wine is. Yeah. So I'm gonna shove the alcohol, tannin, and acid into my already preconceived notion of what I'm drinking. I think it's probably the number one mistake that we make as whenever we're blind tasting.
We do, because we want to get it right. We want to know that we're good enough to get this correct on the first go. And sometimes we try and jam a square peg into a round hole, no matter what happens.
So I want to talk about New Zealand. And I said this before we started, a lot of this podcast, it's going to be a love letter to New Zealand wine. I talk about it all the time. I spent 2 weeks in the North Island, and the one thing I didn't drink my entire time was Sauvignon Blanc. And I guess I kind of want to start here. The same way that Australia, Shiraz helped them and maybe hurt them, or in Ontario, ice wine helps get it on the map, but then everyone just thinks, oh, Canada, ice wine, which, I mean, our Chardonnays, Pinots are incredible. And I'm wondering, for New Zealand, the Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, how much of that helped get New Zealand on the wine map, and how much does it hurt New Zealand in today's day in terms of trying to move people past what New Zealand is, which is far more than that grape in that area?
It's a really good couple of questions. First of all, Sauvignon Blanc did put us on the map, and it was Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc that did that. The Bill and Ross Spence, the two brothers that established some of the early clones of Sauvignon Blanc in Auckland, of all places, really got that ball rolling. They are two heroes of the Sauvignon Blanc story, but it was Marlborough and Marlborough's cool, you know, dry, quite windy climate with high sunshine hours that created this expression of Sauvignon Blanc that was explosive on the nose, explosive in the palate with the acidity and concentration of flavor. And that caught the attention of wine judges in the Northern Hemisphere, in particular the UK. So, you know, Sauvignon Blanc really is the beginning of our legendary story. To answer your second question, we very quickly became a victim of our own success, because if Sauvignon Blanc is the it variety and it wine from New Zealand, it makes every other variety and style not important. And so we ramped up the volume of production of Sauvignon Blanc to export mainly. And the attention to what other varieties we had here was insignificant. It didn't matter to so many brands. But ultimately, the international palate got a bit tired of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and the Marlborough expression. What else have you got? And as soon as they asked that question, what else have you got? Then the doorway to Chardonnay of all, you know, the other varieties that we had started to swing open a little wider, and then Pinot Noir a little wider again. And, you know, ultimately sparkling wine, and even some of our Cabernets and Syrah to today, riding a lovely wave of popularity. But Sauvignon Blanc has had to respond and react to that as well. And the model of the classic Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc was only that which was sought after. And we're still a victim of that success even today. Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, the word Marlborough and Sauvignon Blanc together push sales. And funnily enough, we cannot grow, produce, and make enough Sauvignon Blanc to export. But what listeners need to realize as well is that we grow Sauvignon Blanc in all 11 of our wine regions of New Zealand. So we have 11 different soil type expressions. The climate's largely cool anyway, and that level of herbaceousness goes up and down, that tropical fruit goes up and down with the movement. You know, we're in the middle of Organic Week here in New Zealand, and the incidence of organically or biodynamically farmed Sauvignon Blanc is pushing the boundaries and offering all these different styles. So Sauvignon Blanc is important, has remained important, will continue to do so. But there's so much more to our wine story than that variety, for which we're grateful.
Which is kind of where I want to go to. And this is nothing against the Crawfords, the Oyster Bays, anywhere else, the Sauvignon Blancs. You know, you can get a bottle for $18 to $20, which when you consider it's got a ship from that one corner of planet Earth to Canada, and, you know, it's still a great value. But let's go into a couple different places. The place that shocked me the most was a small island just east of Auckland, Waiheke Island. And I was like, okay, this is your tourist place. And, oh, they have wineries. Oh, that'll be fun. I was shocked. The level of depth and complexity on the Bordeaux blends, the Cab Merlots. I was wondering if you just, and I hate to do this. I'm going to do an instructional course for the listener, but I'm going to do a little bit of it. That was one of the things that sticks out for me, this little island that makes crazy depth Bordeaux style wines.
You've nailed it. Auckland is a wine region that is quite large in terms of scale. Just to paint that picture, it would take you 1.5 hours to drive from the southern border of Auckland to the northern border of Auckland. And Waiheke Island is part of that geography, but it's far enough off the coast, the east coast of Auckland. You know, it's only a 30-minute ferry ride, but it's far enough out that it has its own microclimate. It is, on average, about 5 degrees warmer than the mainland. You can see the weather patterns coming towards you, and they tend to dodge the island more than hit the island, especially rain weather events. But being an island that's essentially a rock these days, it has the ability or the geography within that island to have isolated pockets of serious microclimates to grow fantastic and ripen varieties like Cabernet that you mentioned before. But Sauvignon Blanc, there's a second island off Waiheke Island called Ponui Island, and there are about 5 or 6 vineyards there owned by Man of War, and they're growing Pinot Gris and Sauvignon Blanc there. That's remarkably great wine.
Well, why'd you tell me that now? Now I'm going to have to want to go back. I mean, that's not fair.
You can't go there. You need permission to actually go there, and you can't sort of anchor your boat there. You can't do that. But you can see it from Waiheke Island for sure.
So then let's go a little bit further south, and let's go with Hawke's Bay and Gimlet Gravels. And I recommend to everyone, fly into Auckland, then drive 5 hours south. 3.5 hours, you're just twisting up and down the mountains. It's a tough car ride. But then you hit Napier, which is a great spot to just sort of, you know, set yourself up. If people can't afford Northern Rhone, if some of the French Syrahs are too expensive, the Syrahs in Gimlet Gravels and in Hawke's Bay are just remarkable. And I was wondering your thoughts about that. It's just your thoughts on that grape in that region.
Well, one thing that Hawke's Bay has to its advantage, more so in the last 5 years than the last 10 years, is vine age. And I think with vine age, when we've got vineyards that are 20, 25, 30 years in the ground, notwithstanding, you know, replanting programs and things like that, what that has meant is vine maturity plus intense vineyard management equals wines of concentration. And our climate is such down there that it does emulate the Rhone Valley and Bordeaux at the same time. Funnily enough, people, few listeners might realize or might not realize that we have at least 15 that I'm aware of producers of Pinot Noir from Hawke's Bay. But so it is that climate once again, and of course you mentioned Gimlet Gravels, but it's also vineyards closer to the coastline, in a place where Tiawonga is, producers like Clearview, Elephant Hill, they have some amazing vineyards out there that are ocean influenced.
The Chardonnay, the Elephant Hill started up. I was lucky enough to try the first vintage of Elephant Hill Chardonnay sitting at lunch over, you know, just overlooking the ocean. It might be my favorite lunch of all time. Yes, just to your point. Elephant Hill Chardonnay is fantastic.
Yeah. And they just have a new winemaker on board this year, funnily enough. Steve Skinner, who was the winemaker, is decided to take a break from the wine industry. And his successor is a guy called Hugh Crichton. And Hugh was the key winemaker for the Vital Estate brand for many years, and is a wonderful successor to Steve. So the Elephant Hill story will continue. Great wines, really, really great wines. Fabulous Chardonnay, funnily enough, if you get the opportunity to try their Salome Chardonnay, highly recommended.
Yeah.
So Gimlet Gravels, I mean, yeah. Going back to that, there's a number of producers there. It's interesting that Chris Pask, who's part of the story of establishing the Gimlet Gravels, along with I can't remember his name, Alan from Stonecroft Wines, they got that story started and realized the potential of that very, very finite piece of land. But the winemaker for Pask Wines, CJ Pask at that time, was a wonderful person called Kate Radburn. And she just a few years ago established her own brand called Radburn Wines, and she's producing phenomenal Syrah, world-class Chardonnay, and Merlot Cabernet blend. You know, it's fantastic stuff. So the story continues with the same people just weaving their web throughout that industry. But New Zealand's wine industry is really small. If I can just point out, you know, we only have 717 odd brands for the entire country. And I would say at least 600 of those are classified bespoke. They're small producers. There's not that much volume out there.
Well, I mean, we'll get to the Pinot Noir side of things, but let's go where you're going there, Cam. New Zealand is such an incredible success story. You can't go to almost any country in the world that, you know, like any, you will always find New Zealand wine. Your population is about 5 million. It takes 21 hours to travel there from Toronto. It's a long flight. I did it sitting in the middle of a 5-seater, and I didn't know the people sitting to the left or right of me, but I was flying standby, so I'm not going to complain. But I was wondering, it's one of the most remarkable wine success stories, a country so small in the middle of nowhere, and yet your imprint is everywhere.
I guess part of that imprint story is the freedoms that we have. We are not bound by other than, you know, basic winemaking rules, you know, the handbook of winemaking and the legal side of that. We're not bound by rules. We're not controlled. We don't have to harvest on a particular day. We don't have to meet minimum alcohol levels or acid levels. So our freedoms, is what I'm trying to say, is our freedoms have given us the ability to explore, expand, refine. In saying that, also, a lot of the successful winemakers have learned a lot of their craft internationally. They've done vintages overseas, many of them, very many successful ones. But we've also got a number of very successful import winemakers as well, from around the world, from the USA, from Canada, from Australia especially, and even from South America. So our story is wide and varied based on the people that are here, but the freedoms that we have in terms of viticulture as well. And we're ideally suited because, you know, we're stuck in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in the Southern Hemisphere, surrounded by water. And you're right, it takes a long time to get here, but once you're here, you'll see that it's practically perfect.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I mean, as I said, I think I've been to, you know, France and Italy a bunch of times, but New Zealand might have been my favorite trip. So let's go to the South Island and just much like I said, if you can't afford Cote Roti, try Hawke's Bay. If you can't afford Chambertin or Chambou-Moussigny, then try Otago and Martinborough. And by the way, though, for people rushing thinking you're going to get it for $19.95, you're not. You're probably going to be paying, you know, $29 to $69.70. But I was just wondering if you could just tell people a little bit about just those two regions and what those Pinots mean. And while we're, you know, I'm drinking a beautiful South Island from the Schubert, the 2016, their entry-level Pinot. It's their entry-level, and it's just ridiculous in terms of depth and complexity.
Yeah. Well, you know, geologically speaking, New Zealand is quite young compared to, say, Australia or, you know, many parts of the Northern Hemisphere. And the further south you go, the older the soils get. You mentioned Martinborough in the North Island, and it's a region that we call the Wairarapa, and there are several sub-regions there, but it's mostly built on this combination of, you know, wind-blown material that has built up. There are several terraces there, gravelly soils under the silty wind-blown material, and that delivers a very particular expression of Pinot Noir, which is that voice of place comes through very, very strongly. So people who are interested in Pinot Noir and want that voice of place, it's very strong in the wines from the Wairarapa, Martinborough in particular, Gladstone, Featherstone wineries from there. When you jump to the South Island, and we'll bypass Nelson and Marlborough, they do great Pinot anyway.
They do. Apologies.
The North Canterbury, and this is where a stronger, more intense seam of limestone starts to appear in our soils. And so that limestone connection that you might make between New Zealand and Burgundy, we'll say, there's a lot of limestone in Burgundy, right, especially around Chambou-Moussigny and Bone area. You can see those limestone pebbles everywhere, right? We don't have limestone pebbles littering on the ground, but we have limestone below the ground. And that gives a great, it pushes the idea of acidity, a different fruit profile for wines from North Canterbury. You mentioned Central Otago, and this is a very isolated piece of geography in New Zealand. It's inland and at elevation. So we don't have ocean influence there. We have Southern Alps influence, and it's actually quite a dry continental climate most of the year. It does snow, it does rain occasionally. So low rainfall, continental climate, and schist quartz, hard ground in central Otago. And this pushes the idea of these strong, dark cherry, black raspberry flavors in the central Otago wines. But they also have wild thyme growing everywhere. And wild thyme is part of the character of that place. And you can smell that in a lot of the Pinot Noir, that savory expression, but great acidity. So very different stories based on geography specifically and soil type. But, you know, the Pinot Noir story is fantastic from both those places.
Oh, yeah, it is. Actually, by the way, one thing, circling back when you mentioned about Gimlet Gravels, the one advantage over the last 5-10 years is vine age. It actually kind of reminds me a little bit of Southern Ontario, where our Pinots and our Chards, the quality, especially the single vineyard ones, have gone through the roof. And part of it was it just took time. It just took time for the vines to get older, vines to get more mature, dig down deeper, and just give that extra complexity. I mean, part of the story of any newer region creating consistently higher quality wines, sometimes it's a boring answer of it just takes time. It literally, there's nothing else than that.
Yeah. I think adding on to that idea, that stream of thought or consciousness is if you think of a vineyard or a collection of vineyards as a community and a holistic community that feeds itself, that eventually the equilibrium will be there. It's holistic, it's complete. And so what happens below the ground influences heavily what happens on the ground, and the climate, the atmosphere, the you know, the season, for want of a better terms, if that's all in harmony, then things are going to come right. The only way to stuff it up is with poor winemaking from that point. If you've got a great, happy vineyard that's performing well, the only thing that's going to muck that up is your winemaker. And, you know, fortunately in places like Ontario and single vineyard expressions, and the same here in New Zealand, we have great winemakers that know what they're doing.
Yep. No, it's absolutely true. All right. We've done all the classes, and I had about four or five more viticulture questions for you, but I'm not going to do it. Maybe I can fool you to come on a second time. I want to get back a little bit, just more of your own journey and stuff. In my research, I'm curious, you were helping to create the wine list for like Michelin starred restaurants in New York. I think the Musket Room. I was wondering, what are your memories from that, and what does it take to put together a wine list for, you know, a restaurant of that renown?
Great question. The executive chef at the Musket Room when it first got going is a gentleman called Matt Lambert. And Matt Lambert is an Auckland boy. He grew up in West Auckland, where I live, and he eventually met somebody, his now wife, Barbara, and they moved to the USA together and got the Musket Room going. And like any restaurant in New York, you need multiple backers to make that happen. But there came a point in the establishment of that dining room before they opened that they needed to look at their beverage program, and Matt needed advice. And one of his mentors, chef mentors, was a guy called Michael Meredith. And he's a well-known chef here in New Zealand and well-traveled as well. And Michael said, get Cameron Douglas to do your list. And it was just mere coincidence that I happened to be in New York, because I have family that live in New York, lived on Manhattan Island at the time. They're upstate now. And so I was actually able to travel and live in New York for several weeks at a time when the restaurant was being established. Building relationships with suppliers in a state like New York is a whole different ballgame than it is here in New Zealand. And they're very enthusiastic about showing you 20 wines in 30 minutes or 30 wines in 30 minutes and for you to build your wine list from that. We had to establish a wine list that told the New Zealand story, because it was a New Zealand story restaurant with New Zealand style food and themes. And we were somewhat limited, but we got some great wines from New Zealand on the list there. And it became a success story very, very quickly. It was the only restaurant that I'm aware of that got a Michelin star within 6 months of opening. And I don't think it's there's been a restaurant since that I'm aware of anyway. And it's a combination of building the right team with the right stories, the right food and supplies. And Matt brought a lot of his New Zealand ideas into the theming of that food very successfully.
What would be some of the wineries, winemakers, areas? You said that the Musket Room was going to tell the story of New Zealand wine. If you're telling the story of New Zealand wine with, you know, five or six different wines or producers, and I know that's incredibly limiting, you could probably do it in 40, but what are some that come to mind?
Churton Wines from Marlborough, mm-hmm. Great Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc. To Farreira or TWR Wines, also from Marlborough, funnily enough, Riesling and Pinot Noir again. To Farreira do a great Syrah, by the way. Quartz Reef Wines for their sparkling, bottle fermented sparkling wine, rosé. I think we sold out so many times of Quartz Reef rosé over the years that place has been opened that it was a great way to tell that story. Cumia River from Auckland, of course.
Of course.
Cumia River Wines with their Chardonnay. We did extremely well with them. Man of War, of course, from Waiheke Island.
Yeah.
We did great. Cable Bay from Waiheke Island once upon a time. We did great work with them. Te Mata Estate from Hawke's Bay. You know, so a lot of those classic brands that were available in New Zealand. I don't think Elephant Hill had hit the market quite then. In the USA. They're there now, of course. and central Otago, you know, everything from Mount Difficulty to Maud to Ripon, all of those wines were available to us.
By the way, hearing that answer, I got to tell you, about once every month, I just put into Google New Zealand wine plus Toronto plus consignment wine company. I'm like, can you please, like so many of these wines, like some of the good stuff from Pask is going to be available through Vintages at LCBO in October. And I've been circling it like a shark in Jaws because I want to grab a six pack of that. How has COVID been for you guys in terms of the impact it's had on yourself, on the restaurants, and the wine industry as a whole?
I think like the rest of the world, our hospitality sector has struggled to stay alive. Yeah. I know of a number of restaurants where the landlords have not been kind, and so these places really are on the edge. This open again, close again, open again, close again situation just simply doesn't help them. Yesterday, like I said a little while ago, we reached level three, so we could do click and collect, and there were restaurants that were ready to go, and people are trying to put their money back into the small producers, the restaurants, immediately. And it's not just buying a burger these days, it's buying a proper meal from a restaurant that you want to support. So the population of New Zealand will save hospitality whilst our borders are closed. We've been, touch wood, lucky, but we've also been very, very smart as a population. And when we closed our borders and we went to lockdown, we did as we were told. And we did put masks on. We did sanitize. We did everything we were told to do because we wanted to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And that is why we've had only 30-odd fatalities because of COVID in total in 2020 and only one this year. And so we've just learned to live with these new rules, and we function quite normally otherwise. It's like wearing a seatbelt, right? In the 80s, putting a seatbelt on was like, why should I do that? But now it's normal, and it's just, let's just wear a mask and get on with life, please. And we do that.
It's funny, a lot of the problems you guys are having here in Ontario as well, open and close, trying to support restaurants. My little local favorite places, I don't need to buy a bottle of wine. It's the only thing I have in my home, but every time I go to a restaurant, I try to buy a bottle because, you know, it's just, it's a way to support. And how are you? Tell people, like I don't know if people from Ontario can benefit, but tell people a little bit about your services at camdouglasms.com. There are people that listen to this pod all around the world. And, you know, we met, you know, just for the listeners to know, we met once ages ago at my favorite French restaurant in Toronto at Le Select Bistro. I still have our menu from that day.
Good.
I still have it, but where can people get in touch with you and just tell the listeners a little bit about the services you do?
Well, I'm a great believer in multiple income streams and touching the world of wine and food in many, many different ways. So currently, of the many things that I do, I run this website from my home, and it is a wine review or wine and beverage review website. So I receive wine samples on a daily basis, and I taste them and I put my notes online. I receive many more wine and beverage samples that I taste for different publications. So we have one in Australasia called Mind Food, and it is subscribed by about 250,000 people, and it's in print once a month. And I have six pages in that magazine that I write for once a month. There's a lot of work involved in tasting and promoting that. I write for a magazine for On Trade called The Shout. I'm a full-time lecturer at a university, and I'm the cook at home. I love cooking. I love tasting wine. I love paying it forward. When we're not in a lockdown situation and we can travel, I do represent the Quartermaster Sommeliers, historically in America, but also in Australasia now more than ever, teaching and running those assessment programs, helping people become SOMs.
What is the last great meal that you cooked, and what was the wine you had with it?
Wow. Well, I tell you what I cooked last night, because my wife, Janet, really, really wanted me to do it. We had South Island blue cod, pan-seared, with homemade eggplant parmigiana. And you adjust the recipe a little bit, but we had New Zealand-made Parmesan cheese. We had a sourdough wholemeal crumb with homegrown parsley on the top. And what did I drink with it? I actually had a glass of Hawke's Bay wine, a Smith & Chef wine, Steve Smith, MW, and I can't remember his name now. the major investor from the USA, his last name is Chef. I had their Cantera wine, which is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Tempranillo, New Zealand grown. Mm-hmm. And the foray into other varieties that we grow here in New Zealand. I know we haven't touched on it yet, but it was a fantastic wine. Yeah, Michael Chef, by the way. Steve Smith, Michael Chef.
All right, nice. Okay, good. Then we ended on a high note. You get it right. Listen, we're pretty much almost at an hour now, Cam. I so much appreciate you doing the pod. I'm going to be bugging you for other winemakers, wine writers from New Zealand. I'd love to have more of them on this podcast, but I wish you nothing but the best. I appreciate you taking the hour here, and I always enjoy corresponding with you. And again, for people out there, if you haven't investigated the wines of New Zealand, you really need to. From if you need an alternative from Chardonnay, if you can't afford Burgundy or Northern Rhone and so many other things in between, New Zealand is so much more than just the mass-produced Sauvignon Blanc. And again, nothing against the mass-produced Sauvignon Blanc, but New Zealand will open your eyes to so many different flavor profiles. A fantastic country of under 5 million. It's a remarkable story that's only getting better. And Cameron, I appreciate so much you doing the podcast today.
You're welcome. And if anybody's interested in learning a little bit more about New Zealand after the podcast, because I don't do podcasts, you're the expert at that. But I have done a few interviews recently with some winemakers, and they can just jump on my website and click on the journal section. There's one in particular just gone up that even you might be interested in, because it's a producer called Burn Cottage from Central Otago.
Of course.
Organic biodynamic producer. And I just chatted with their winemaker, Claire, for a little while just a few days ago. So it sort of, you know, expands the story of New Zealand. And people can just watch 5 or 10 minute slots at a time if they wanted to.
And that, of course, is at camdouglasms.com, correct?
Correct.
Perfect. Cam, thank you so much for doing the pod.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.